I like him, Ma. I like him a lot.
I know you do, sweetheart. I like him, too. He's handsome, charming, smart. Obviously works out more than once a week. I just don't like him for you.
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast. Each week, we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show to find out if it still holds up 17 years later. I'm Patrick Randall.
I'm Matt Dominguez.
This episode is called Accentuate the Positive. It's number 9 in season 2 of Queer as Folk.
It first aired in the U.S. on March 10th, 2002.
It was directed by Bruce McDonald, my favorite director so far. He directed 8 episodes of Queer as Folk, and this is his second. His first was episode 6, Mixed Blessings. We gave that episode good reviews, and of course, Bruce McDonald also directed 17 episodes of Degrassi, The Next Generation.
That explains why one of the actors that we're so excited to talk about is in this episode.
Definitely.
Accentuate the Positive was written by Ron Cohen and Daniel Lipman, along with Ephraim Seeger, who wrote the teleplay. This is his second of 8 episodes as a writer, and he also produced 34 episodes of Queer as Folk, so he's pretty familiar. And we can't forget that he also wrote 6 episodes and produced 19 episodes of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
I cannot believe that. I hated that show.
How dare you?
Well, remember last episode that he wrote, we talked about how I know how to do the Carlton dance. So
we'll be posting video on our Facebook page later tonight.
It's not unusual. The Showtime synopsis for this episode. Michael fights to get Ben back into his life, but first, he must prove that he can handle the HIV-positive situation, while Brian is introduced to his mother's minister, a man he's already met in very different circumstances.
That's, yes, putting it lightly.
It's a very dramatic synopsis from Showtime this week.
IMDb synopsis. Michael decides to win Ben back, no matter how much Brian and Debbie are against the union. Ted tries Viagra. Brian's new man turns out to be his mother's priest.
So some spoilers there, as usual, in IMDb.
I wouldn't say that the priest is his new man.
No, nor are Brian and Debbie against the union. About the only thing really accurate in this is Michael decides to win Ben back and Ted takes Viagra.
Yeah, that's literally
next.
It.
I did like this episode mostly because it was a Bruce McDonald episode. I jotted down a bunch of things that he does in these episodes that really set them apart from other Queer as Folk episodes. They just look different. They feel different. They sound different. He does a lot of split screens with phone calls. Another caller joined like smack in the middle of the split screen.
Yes.
Thor. We'll talk about Thor.
Yes. It was definitely Thor because he was talking about Lulu, his poor dog.
Poor Lulu was throwing up. Bruce McDonald also does these kind of urban life transitions between scenes. When we first saw it, we were a little like, meh, on it.
Was that when they went to New York?
No, no. This was the last episode that he directed in season 2, where it was, in quotes, Pittsburgh.
Oh, yes.
There's a nice shot that he uses of Michael and Ben walking down the street that we saw when they first had this meetup outside the comic book store. It's that really shallow depth of field, everything behind them and in front of them is bouqueted out. There's steam coming out of the streets. He had this kind of trademark. I called it the NYPD blue look.
The exact phrase that was in my head.
Yeah, I liked it.
To say that it's the city, it's gritty.
Right. There were quite a few moments of comedy mixed in with these usual visual sight gags. There was a really interesting pulsating transition into the church, complete with a bell ringing right on cue. There's long shots that really pull us into an environment of a scene versus just a traditional head and shoulders two shot of actors. So I like being able to see the surroundings of the scene that's going on. Lots of extreme close-ups like he used in the last episode. There is a great shot of Brian and his mother's hands in the church. We'll talk about that when we get there. He also used a grainy black and white fade to color intro to Babylon again. He did that in the other episode, which we like. There's a really nice follow shot of Ben and Michael when they're starting to hook up. Great use of a Pet Shop Boys song in the ending scene. And one thing that I noticed about music here is that McDonald carried songs across different scenes. So there was a scene where Brian and his mother were in the kitchen that had a vaguely hip-hop song playing that immediately transitioned along with the video into the playground scene where they're playing basketball. It was the same song, and that was really interesting. I looked for a cameo of Bruce McDonald in this episode. He appeared twice in the last one. He was the film director of Backsides in Motion, which was...
Oh, he was the porn director. Oh,
yeah, and he was also an extra in Babylon. You could see him in that shot there. I couldn't find him in a cameo here, unless he was the awful guy singing karaoke. I don't think it was him, though.
No, he looks too different. He looks very different from the porn director.
Yeah, maybe they cleaned him up.
That karaoke. Woof.
So this episode starts out as a lot of season one episodes did, which is in Babylon.
Hooray.
We find out that Ben is a terrible dancer, even with glitter stuck to his shirtless, muscular torso.
Now, do you see why it's okay that he's a terrible dancer when you just described what he looked like?
Well, he was kind of doing like the running man on the dance floor, completely out of beat with everybody else.
He was in his own world. He was living his life. I was very into it.
Yeah, what did he call it last episode? He wants to live in the now?
Yes. And you thought he was having this very profound moment. And what did he do? He took Michael to Babylon.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know what? That's great.
I thought that Michael was a little too wrapped up in Ben this soon. They'd only had one date so far.
Yes. He seemed almost utterly obsessed. Yeah. I thought I was borderline obsessed with Ben to the point where I'm like, honey, I think you need to calm down a little.
Well, the thing that I thought about that was, from a storytelling perspective, it didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. But then I was thinking, yeah, I've been in that position before where I've met somebody and they made just such a spectacular flash of light in my life that I did become a little like, kind of the way that Michael did. So it didn't seem totally out of place to me.
I will say, when I first started dating, I definitely fell into that.
Where you wrote his name over and over?
Not so much that, but like there was like the texting every day and for like long periods of time, and thinking that there was going to be some magical relationship that's going to come out of this. And it's like, you've known each other for 2 weeks.
So here's something that Michael does that was a little like, okay, I think this is cute, but it's also like these days a little creepy. But I think in 2002 it wasn't so creepy, which is he stalked Ben to his house and kind of waited on the sidewalk.
Ben.
Hey.
Michael. What a coincidence. Am I running into you?
Not really. I live here. Well, it's nice seeing you.
The truth is, I've been walking up and down the block for 2 hours waiting for you.
Would you like to come up?
I just think that in 2002, before instant communication, you have to run into people in order to talk to them.
That's very true. And that tends to be the way, I think, 1990s to early 2000s romantic movies and television scenes. That's how they do their meet cute.
Yeah.
To make you want to root for the couple. But imagine trying to do that in 2018. It's a little like,
call the police. There's a guy on the sidewalk.
Did you add them on Find My Friends and not tell them? Like, that's knowing where my location is very creepy now.
I know where you live.
And like, and I am out of here.
It was nice to see Michael being so awkward when he was trying to re-engage Ben. I found it endearing, but I also thought that it was really naive of Michael to think that he could just jump right back into things with Ben by telling him that he overreacted to finding out that Ben was HIV positive.
I won't say that he overreacted to his finding out that he's HIV positive, but more that he thought it was too much for him to handle. Because remember that when they ended things, it was them about to have sex and him seeing the medication and thinking, that's it, I can't do it.
Yeah.
So like, he on the surface understood what it meant for him to be with someone who is HIV positive, but then he let the feeling really sink in, and that's what ate at him. And so I don't want to say that he overreacted, but he definitely rushed to judgment in terms of ending it the way he did.
Kudos to Ben for shutting him down, though. It was like,
oh, it was great.
Nice try, kid, but.
He's like, oh no, it's fine. You tried it though. And he just moves on.
Yeah, let's listen real quick to Ben's explanation of why he's not going to get back together. Well, get back together? Got together with Michael. Here we go.
Look, I appreciate your coming to see me. And everything you said, that this time it would be different. But I can't take that chance. I need to know that if I allow myself to love someone, that they're not going to bail on me. No matter what their friends or their mothers say, I need to know they'll be there. So I'm sorry, but it takes more than a kiss.
So fair comment, but I think that's a lot to ask of somebody that you basically just met and are still getting to know.
Yeah, they're talking about love and like long-term stuff. I'm like, can't you date for a second?
Yeah, that was really accelerated.
The waters on how you feel about knowing them as a person before you're saying like, if I'm going to, you know, spend my life with you, it's like,
yeah,
I've known you for about 10 minutes.
So. Right, exactly. I don't even know where you went to college, kid. One funny thing about this whole Ben and Michael story was where the whole episode turned into the movie White Men Can't Jump, where Ben is playing basketball in what I think could be described as a hood.
It was definitely a different side of Pittsburgh that we had not seen.
I mean, what was Michael doing there? Did he stalk him there too? How did he find him at the basketball court?
I mean, obviously, you know, he must have, or I don't know. I thought at first, just because of the way the scene transitioned, that he stayed with Ben as Ben went back to his house, and that like, did he just follow him as he went to the basketball game?
Oh, you think this was the same day? No, it wasn't, because this was Sunday morning, because I only know that for something we'll talk about in a little bit, which is Brian and his mother going to church.
Then Michael clearly just camped outside Ben's apartment
the entire night.
Yeah, and then waited until he's like, oh, hey, you know what? I'll go to your basketball game with you.
Maybe he slept on the sofa. I was really disappointed, though, that Michael had reverted back to the Michael as buffoon while trying to talk about sports.
NFL should sign you up.
That's football.
Right. I'm in the NBL.
There is no NBL.
Okay, I don't know anything about basketball. In case you haven't noticed, I'm queer.
Yo, know, I love basketball. In case you haven't noticed, I'm queer too.
Oh, I've noticed.
And also that whole argument of like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm not great at basketball. Remember, I'm queer.
Yeah, and of course, Ben is queer and is good at basketball.
Ben seems to be good at everything.
Ben loves basketball, but then we never, ever hear about basketball ever again in the series. I don't even think Hunter played basketball. Hunter swam.
Just for convenience and to give us a different take on Pittsburgh, I think that's why Ben liked basketball today.
There was a line that one of the other basketball players used, which I tripped over, which... he says,
I suggest you say yes, because if he's like the bitch I got at home, I'm going to be standing here all day.
I thought that was a little crude.
It definitely was, especially with him saying that right in front of Michael.
I don't know if it's okay to call one's partner a bitch anymore,
but,
right?
Right. But can I also say that I found it very interesting to see that these group of men are clearly very cool with Ben being gay? I don't know why. I guess I didn't expect that from this crowd. And I like that they just sort of went with it.
Mm-hmm. Michael somehow trapped Ben into a date. He grabbed the ball and wouldn't give the ball up until Ben would agree to go on a date. I thought it was funny. But this scene was like so unlike anything else that we have seen in Queer as Folk so far. First of all, it's an exterior.
Right. And but then also like this was like that sort of very much romantic comedy. Like they're trying to be a little too saccharine sweet with it. But I do like that there's at least the pushback from Ben of like, all right, fine, I'll do it.
Yeah.
Because clearly I have to do something to get rid of you.
Well, then the date ends up being meet me at Woody's. And so Ben was sort of the stunt double for that date, because Michael invites him to a date, like meet up at Woody's. Oh, come on and sit with the guys. And Ben's like, not ready for that. And I think it's only fair that if you ask somebody out, there's an expectation that it'll be one-on-one unless otherwise indicated. Like, let's meet up at Woody's and you can meet my friends.
Especially when it's sort of like a do-over.
Right.
Yeah. So it's like, he's got to literally start again and trying to impress Ben and show that he's much more relaxed than he was previously. But I also feel like he did that to sort of show up his friends. Like, see how cool I am with it? Do you have a problem? It felt like he was trying to prove himself to Ben, and I feel like that's putting a lot of pressure on Ben.
There was also the angle that he needed to prove himself to the rest of the gang, who was saying, no, the guy's positive, stay away from him. So it was kind of a complicated scene, and why do you think Ben walked out, though? It wasn't that bad. I wouldn't have walked
out. But it still felt like Ben was being used. Yeah, I was receiving it as very much like, he is being used so that Michael can prove something to his friends. They're like, look, I can date a positive guy, no problem.
Well, he gave up after 2 minutes, though. He just kind of sat down, and Emin and Brian were kind of catty about something, and Ben's just like, I'm out of here.
Oh, but Ben says something, and I thought that was like, I felt that burn. It's what he says to Michael.
Let's listen to it real quick.
You said, let's get together, and we did.
Oof.
I literally went like, ouch.
I think that makes it more endearing because we see that Ben is not just playing hard to get, he is hard to get. So there's that endearing thing there where you got to keep trying and you got to be able to pay your dues in order to get to somebody versus them just throwing themselves at you and sleeping on the first date, which they tried to do, but didn't work.
And that's because Ben is really such a catch. And I really like that. And he's saying like, no, you have to earn me after the BS that I've been through in a short amount of time that we tried to date.
I thought this way that Michael re-engaged Ben was awful. Let me jump up and sing karaoke to you. But
can we talk about the first karaoke guy doing hot stuff? Because,
I think everybody's seen like the awful karaoke person.
It went on for so long though.
Yeah. I mean, it was the soundtrack for that scene. It was the backing music. So
it was it was distracting. I feel like I want to focus on these characters, but I'm hearing that in the background. And then he like dedicates it to like the only hot stuff he'll ever need.
You're my hot stuff too, baby. I love the look on everybody's face when Michael started singing. Everybody had a slightly different look. It was just really funny because nobody, I'm gathering, had ever seen Michael do that before.
Well, and did you know that Hal Sparks was actually in a band, so he is actually a good singer?
Boy, somebody needed to blow the pitch pipe first, though. Because
I know, because he started out in his falsetto right away, and like, I don't think your voice sits comfortably there.
So far, Michael is just acting so weird towards Ben that if I was Ben, I would have run for dear life from this guy. It'd be like, you are like way too bizarre and trying too hard. Like,
way too hard.
Yeah. It's like you need to have a little bit of a chase involved. Mm-hmm. And instead, Michael's just like all over it. It's like, okay, calm down, kid. So this was really early to be inviting a guy to meet Michael's parents.
I promised my mother I'd have dinner with her and my Uncle Vic.
Some other time then?
No. No. Dinner tomorrow night.
Second or third date, come meet my family.
That took me 3 months the last time I was in a relationship. Yeah. But really, Ben was somehow impressed by the karaoke enough to say, I'll give you a shot. Or it was more that like,
wouldn't have worked for me.
He said, it took a lot of balls to go up there and do that. I'm like,
okay. Well, he starts out, you are a terrible singer. The dinner at Debbie's was a little bit of a callback to that dinner that Michael had with Dr. David. There was the same interrogation.
So excited. She was excited
that Michael's bringing somebody over, and then they interrogate the guy. Ben and Dr. David both brought flowers for Debbie. Ben's were better. Ben had a great big bouquet, and Dr. David had just, I don't know, a couple lilies or something, which are funeral flowers.
I think maybe that was symbolism that relationship was never going to last.
Debbie was just so cunty about Ben, though.
She found the chase and cut right to it.
I like him, Ma. I like him a lot.
I know you do, sweetheart. I like him, too. He's handsome, charming, smart. Obviously works out more than once a week. I just don't like him for you.
So she's sarcastic and funny. I think she had a point, though, where she's telling Michael that he needs to ask permission. You can't just bring anybody over to that house because it's not his house, right?
Well,
I would have asked permission.
Well, to counter that,
no surprises.
Debbie was telling Vic how excited she was that Michael was bringing a man over without her having to ask him to. And she was so excited about that this could be the one because he's so excited about who he's bringing over. And you see that deflate when she sees that it's Ben.
Yeah, I just think that Michael was just being a provocateur with that. And I don't think that that's appropriate to do. I think if you're bringing somebody to dinner and you know that your mother has a problem with it, you ask first. I would. I wouldn't just show up because for two reasons. I think it's disrespectful to Debbie. And I also think that it puts Ben into a very, very bad place. And I don't think that somebody in a new relationship should be doing that to somebody that they're trying to woo. So Michael keeps putting Ben into these like bad situations. Come to Woody's. Okay. Oh, sit down with the guys. Come to dinner with my mother. By the way, my mother hates you.
She hates him. I think she can recognize that Ben is a good person, but she does hold his status against him only because it's her child.
Well, Michael admits to Debbie that he loves Ben. And it's like,
which again, whoa, yeah, way too soon.
Date four or five, three. Well, they played basketball.
I think it's 2.5 at this point. Yeah. I can't tell.
Debbie's interrogation of Ben was pretty similar to the one that she gave Dr. David, but it was way more serious because remember she was asking Dr. David, how much money do you make? What kind of car do you drive?
Do you think it was, would you say that it's so serious to the point that it's sinister?
I don't know. At first I thought that Cohen and Lippman were recycling some writing from the first season to put us into this mode of being able to remember it, but then also seeing that there's something different about this. It's more serious. It's not the older gay man driving a Jag that's a chiropractor and is comfortable. It's Ben, the professor who's HIV positive, who can carry himself. So it was strange.
It was, because she didn't dance around the subject. Like, the first question out of her mouth was, how long have you been positive?
Let's listen to her interrogation of Ben real quick.
So how long you been positive, Ben?
Mother.
I'd just like to know.
That's okay, I'm fine with it. 5 years.
What's your T-cell count?
It's 600.
Ever been hospitalized?
No, not yet. Knock wood.
Viral load?
Undetectable.
On the cocktail?
Antivirals.
What the fuck do you think you're doing?
This is the reality, sweetheart. And you're just gonna have to live with it.
To me, it would have made sense for Debbie as a character, given her history, especially with Vic in the house, that when she hears that, that should provide some relief.
Yeah, Vic had he had no lines at this particular moment, but Jack Weatherall was doing all face acting. He had these steely eyes, thousand-yard stare, blank face as Debbie's asking all these questions, because he knew better than anybody else what they meant. And he was a little embarrassed that Debbie was asking them. He also wanted to know the answers, though. So kudos to Jack Weatherall there in that scene. I really liked it.
Yeah, he had to know that it wasn't his place to jump in and, say, defend Ben or try to rein Debbie in. He just sort of let it play out.
Yeah.
And you can see that Michael is just seething.
Ben didn't have a problem with it, though. He completely owned that conversation. He didn't take offense to that very forward interrogation from somebody's mother that he barely knew.
And I think that's a really progressive stance for this show to take, especially in 2002, to provide a character who is HIV positive, who is not ashamed by his status,
mm-hmm.
and doesn't try to hide it, or doesn't, as you say, take offense to the line of questioning. Because, you know, in the next scene after the dinner, Ben says, there's a reason why she's asking this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was defending it.
I have to applaud the show for being able to not shy away from it in that moment.
It was a big moment. So far, we had seen HIV positive character, which was Vic, just portrayed as a sickly, barely able to function, kind of dotty old guy mm-hmm. creeping around Debbie's house. But here we have big, strong Ben showing the exact opposite.
Right, you know, and saying that he's never been hospitalized. And even as he's taken that kind of beating from the group of friends about how terrible he is because he's positive, especially with Ted trying to put that in Michael's head, to see Ben, like, take no punches with it.
Yeah.
Was really impressive.
I didn't like this final line from Debbie.
This is the reality, sweetheart. And you're just going to have to live with it.
It seemed that she was trying to be very sanctimonious, but when she was doing that, she was just knocking Michael's legs out from him right in front of his date. I don't think that she needed to say that. Michael knew damn well what was going on. He probably knew just as well as Debbie did. So I didn't think that Debbie needed to kind of take a swing at him like that.
She definitely throws his own words back at him with that. Like, literally, because with that line, was, this is the reality. You're just going to have to live with it. Like, that was pretty calculated on her part.
Yeah, but it seemed like it was designed to hurt Michael or to kind of dissuade him from being interested in Ben. And I didn't think that Debbie needed to remind Michael what it meant to date a positive person.
To sort of play the devil's advocate with that, with at least with what Debbie's trying to accomplish by bringing it up, is to say that I know you feel this romantic feeling for Ben. I don't want you to keep your head in the clouds. And when you see that it might get hard or it might get difficult with what he has to live with, that you're not going to run away. Know that these will be things that you may have to say to a doctor to save his life. Or this might be something that you have to check.
You don't think he would have known that after his life with Uncle Vic?
I feel like it's kind of proof he's sort of aloof in a lot of areas. I mean, the man can't even have like a proper dinner without being instructed.
Or play basketball, for that matter.
Or hold a freaking utensil.
Yeah, his Cro-Magnon spoon holder.
So I think I understand where Debbie's coming from, where she's saying, like, if I can accept this, I hope you can accept that these are going to be the responsibilities. Because she's lived it with Vic. She's had to help a man who was on the brink of death and come back from it.
Well, if that was her intention, she didn't do very well because they immediately fucked.
That's true.
So whatever she had to say, I guess Michael took in, processed, and said, okay, now let's get naked.
Well, okay.
Let's get it on, Ben.
And let's talk about that sex scene.
Ooh.
Because one, yes. Two, we see Michael.
Thank you, Bruce McDonald.
Man. We see Michael taking the condom out and putting it on Ben. And before they really start to get to it, Ben stops Michael and says,
I want you to be very sure.
And as soon as he gets the green light, just look out.
Oh, Michael's legs go right up in the air and Ben is ready to go. And to be honest, it reminded me of the first time I ever had sex with a positive person.
Ooh.
Who,
I'm
going to
pick up my wine glass here for a minute and lean back and listen.
Who also sort of looked like Ben too. Was not mad about it at all. So this is about 4 or 5 years ago.
That's all?
Yeah. I mean,
you were a virgin 4 years ago?
How old am I now? I'm going to be 30.
You turned 30.
I'm going to turn 30.
You turn 30, hon.
I don't turn 30 until the end of August, so don't age me.
You just went to Costa Rica on your 30th birthday.
To celebrate my 30th birthday early. By the way, Costa Rica for 10 days, listeners, highly recommend. There are some great gay bars in San Jose, so feel free to, private message me if you want more details. So, yeah, I was about...
Wait, San Jose is in Costa Rica?
Yeah, San Jose is the capital of Costa
Rica. Oh, okay.
Geography lesson. No, this was the first time I had sex with a positive person, so it wasn't the first time I had sex.
In Costa Rica?
Not in Costa Rica.
Oh, the 4 year ago.
Yes. This was in Chicago about 4, 5, 6 years ago, around there. And it's been a blur lately. And
wait a minute. I'm sorry to interrupt, but that means that when I met you, you were a virgin.
No, I was not a virgin when we met.
So this had to have been more than 4 years ago.
Yes. This was like 2012. I have no concept of time since being
a Debbie
from
have
Costa
a talk with you.
Anyway, so first time we're going to have sex, I know he's HIV positive, and he took every possible precaution and made sure that I felt comfortable, that protection was used, because this was really before PrEP really took off. So, and again, everyone should continue to practice safer sex. It was one of the better sexual experiences I've ever had because it was clear that there was care and tenderness. Yeah, aww. It was actually really nice. Just had to say that.
Oh, you're getting all smiley and misty-eyed. So,
yeah.
Can we call him?
I think I still have his number.
Can we bring him on later?
Sure.
And talk about this? So, first of all, how long ago was this? 4 or 7 years?
I think it had to be about 7 years ago. I think that's what it was. Because it was around I actually first moved here.
Okay. So, Ben and Michael fuck aggressively, hard.
Passionately. Let's go with passionately. I like passionately.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Rating us on iTunes helps other listeners find us, so make sure to rate us and subscribe.
And give us a nice review. We like those. Still, queer as folk. So, the B story here, Brian and his mother. We are introduced to what the scene is going to be about when we see Brian and Justin banging in a blue room that looked sort of like they were doing synchronized topping, like synchronized swimming.
This was definitely at the bathhouse. Because remember, I think the last time we saw blue like that was when Brian saw Dr. David Cameron at the bathhouse.
Well, Bruce McDonald always uses blue for these sex scenes. So you remember that one with the Sigur Rós song in it? That was all blue.
Oh.
That was in episode 2, All Better Now.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And yeah, I love the fact that Brian and Justin are topping two people side by side. And we get a glimpse at the person that Brian is topping. And he seems to have a cross around his neck.
That was a funny shot, too, because the two bottoms were on all fours. And they were almost like one of those penny horses at a supermarket where it's you put the penny in, the horse is kind of going back and forth. Yeah, and these two bottoms were kind of going back and forth, alternating.
They're like a carousel.
Yeah, but they were taking like gigantic forward and backward motions, though. They're probably covering at least like a foot and a half on each one. So
again, the dick size of this cast just doesn't compute all the time because they tend to want to exaggerate how big everybody is.
There's a big moment here where we meet Brian's sister. I think the only scene that we have seen her in so far was the funeral.
It was the wake where she couldn't get her shit together.
Yeah. She had the kids with her again. The ones that Brian had frightened by saying that grandpa's head was in the bowling bag.
These kids.
Oh, they're demon children.
They are the worst fucking kids on the planet.
He did it. No, he did. Faggot.
Homo.
Look,
Sit down and shut up, or I'll make sure your balls never drop.
I don't know whether or not to be mad at Brian's sister or to feel sorry for her.
I never knew that Brian's mother is named Joni. Did you know that?
No, because I think the only time I ever saw her was also at the wake where she was, again, kicking back the wine.
Yeah. I think she was drinking ports on Sunday morning.
To calm her nerves.
Yeah. When Brian got to that house before church, the music that was playing in her house was this light hip hop song. That's the one that overlapped into the basketball scene. So Brian and his mom chilling in the kitchen, listening to some hip hop. Ben and Michael at the playground playing basketball. It was a great transition, but I just bumped on the hip hop playing in Joni Kinney's kitchen at that time.
And I do love that the only reason why Brian's there is because his sister basically said, I'm done.
Yeah.
She's all on you. And Joni seems to be under all these impressions that he's going to help her with this or that. And he's like, fuck that.
Yeah. I didn't know about any of this. Church? What church?
Yeah. And the only reason he went is because she's clearly drunk.
Yeah. Well, that's the only reason Brian went, right?
Yes. That's the only reason why Brian went.
Because Joni goes to church every week.
Right. And, you know, she's like, well, I can go without you. And she almost trips over her damn dining room furniture.
I felt bad for her. She was by herself. She was alone. She was talking about how nobody calls and the phone never rings. Mm-hmm. She has no friends. So I can kind of see how she could have a little nip of port. Well, a big glass of port, I'll call it.
Oh, yeah. Clearly, so it wasn't just one she was having.
My emotional journey with Joni Kinney was an interesting arc. It starts out as feeling bad for her and kind of wishing that things were better for her into what we'll get to in a minute, which is I hate this woman's guts.
We do go on that journey with her.
So let's go on a journey to church and guess who Father Tom Butterfield is in real life. The actor is John Ralston. You know who he played.
He played Miles Hollingsworth II from Degrassi. I lost my fucking mind. I texted you immediately as I found this out because I was like, Degrassi, the next class.
Miles Hollingsworth is the dad, obviously, of Miles III, Hunter, and Frankie in Degrassi.
When you watch Degrassi, the next class, you know that his character, he's a real mean son of a bitch. Like, he cheated on his wife, and he's also been very, like, physically violent. Like, he's a terrible person.
Yeah, I think he hit both Miles and Hunter. Yep. I'm not sure about Frankie, though. I like that Hunter character, too, when he kind of went a little bit crazy and was going to blow up the school.
Because of, like, the video game stuff. That was... Yeah. That was intense.
Yeah. Again, it's just, I love these Degrassi storylines because they put these kids through
everything.
Such serious drama.
I mean, let's just do a quick plug for Degrassi, the next class, because that show takes on so many different amazing topics, from Syrian refugees to LGBTQ characters to systemic racism. They do not shy away from it, and it's incredible to watch.
They put the one boy into a coma. What was his name?
Oh, Miles' ex-boyfriend.
Yeah. He wasn't so much a coma. He became...
Right, because they had the bus accident.
Right.
Spoiler alert, there's a bus accident that happens that, like, I couldn't handle it.
It's been like 2 years. I think spoilers are off the table at this point.
You never know. I just want to say it. Spoiler alert, there's a major bus accident that happens on Degrassi, the next class.
There was this great intercut that Bruce McDonald used between church, where Brian and his mother are, to Ted waking up in bed with his gigantic boner from the Viagra that he had taken.
Like music as he's like waking up over that.
And then it cut right back to church. So I really like the way those two shots were juxtaposed, where you have this solemn thing with the horny priest to Ted in bed with
a massive boner.
Right. And it was just comically staged that it was just like straight up and the sheets had tented around it.
You know what it almost reminded me of? It reminded me of the scene in the original Godfather when the movie producer, Wolf, is in bed waking up and he sees that he's covered in liquid and he's trying to figure out what it is. And it's revealed that his prized horse's head is in his bed. That's what it reminded me of.
Instead, it's a big boner.
Right, because then Ted like screams at the fact that he's hard. I'm like, Ted, have you never had morning wood? I don't.
Well, yeah, I think he was. I think it's because he fell asleep that way and woke up that way, and apparently didn't roll over though. So thank God for that. I think Brian was really amused that he had banged the priest in a bathhouse. I think that just kind of appealed to his sense of humor and his wit.
He could barely keep a straight face, in a manner of speaking.
I like that.
It was very funny. Because I've had those moments where you're like, I know what you've done.
Yeah. It seems like we're back to the lesbians as furniture in the season.
I literally forgot they were in this episode.
Yeah, they were just props. They kind of appeared here and there, had a couple pithy lines, and that was it.
know, they have breakfast in the beginning of the episode. That's about it.
I did like that Justin and Brian made really good use of Ted's Viagra.
Just straight up steal it.
There's this great shot, and I think Bruce McDonald directs like these awesome gay sex scenes where Justin's legs are wrapped around Brian while he's fucking him. And then as soon as they both get off, Justin's legs just lose all strength and they just like collapse. He could no longer hold the position. He just kind of went.
He just down. Falls apart.
Yeah.
Well, from what it sounded like, they've been going for a while.
I can't believe you're fucking me again. It was your idea to steal Ted's Viagra.
Go Justin. What a great bottom.
I think Justin's very proud of bottom.
Brian's mother showed up just in time. And again, it's like all these people just show up places.
She keeps knocking on his door. First of all, I didn't know she knew where he lived.
I was like still on the Joni Kinney. Oh, I feel bad for you. She like made Brian's favorite cake.
Yeah, when she showed up, I thought she was very sincere. And she's like, I want you to know what it meant for you to go to church with me.
Yeah. And she lost her husband. Like, I think at this point, we are led to believe it's maybe 6-7 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
So she's kind of losing it and didn't have that support system. So as soon as Brian started to pay attention to her, she kind of latched onto that and made him a cake and said, I'm going to bring him a cake. So I like that. Justin appeared around the corner, clearly with a heart on, to meet Mama Kinney. And I felt even more bad when that happened because she wasn't quite ready to see that. But then she went all homophobic, and I was like, you cunt.
You can make all the jokes you want. The Bible makes it clear. You're going to hell.
It's like, how dare you?
Wow.
It's like, I felt bad for you, and look what you did.
This is your Tyra moment. We were rooting for you. We were all rooting for you.
And then you went all cunty. God. It was a good scene.
But... Oh, yeah. She turns right around, and she says, you're going to hell.
Yeah.
Elevator out.
Yeah. Oh, Joni Kinney. This episode was a little bit of the return of Brian 1.0, which showed itself when it seemed like he needed to take a dig at Father Tom over being gay. But Father Tom throws it right back into his face, and he comes out of this with the total high ground. Let's listen to that scene real quick.
I understand your feelings of anger, of pain, but they have nothing to do with me or this church. They have to do with you and your mother.
You don't know shit about my mother.
I know a lot more than you. Because I spent time with her. And I talk to her, and I try to offer comfort.
By telling her that I'm going to burn in hell.
I don't teach that lesson. I teach love. I teach truth.
The truth is you're a goddamn liar.
Brian, if you want to betray me, if that's what you need to do, you do it. But I know who I have to answer to. And it isn't you. Now get the fuck out of my church.
The only thing I didn't like was his get the fuck out of my church line. It's like, Father Tom, you're a priest. Don't swear in the church.
He was getting butt fucked at the bathhouse.
Yes,
I think he could say get the fuck out of my church.
But
he clearly isn't following a lot of rules of the priesthood.
He just seemed to not be able to separate the two in that particular line. Whereas the rest of our interactions with Father Tom, he's got two different personas. He's got the priest where he's leading the flock?
Congregation.
Flock, whatever, in liturgy. And he's like a different person. And then when he first sees Brian outside, then he drops into that little sultry priest for a moment.
But I thought they were going to fuck on the altar for a second. I really
did. The altar? Oh my God.
I actually, you know that show that you love to tease me about, Bear, that I directed a couple years ago with the tasteful where I didn't objectify my characters.
As written up in the Chicago Tribune.
Rave review. And one of the things the way I wanted to end Act One was actually having two of the characters, because they're in the church altar at that moment, and we had it set up as if it's ready for the Sunday service the next day. I originally wanted to stage it where they literally threw like the collection plate and the chalices, just like literally swiped them off so they could go to fucking.
Why on earth did you cut that?
I had some people who are Catholic say, okay, that's too far.
Was that in the script?
It was not, no.
Yeah, I think you should stick to the script.
Well, and I mean,
that totally changes the whole play.
No, but they do have sex at the end of Act One. It's just
not on the altar in the church.
Well, no, because the show takes place in a boarding school, and because the setting that in which we staged it was in a church, I was like, I might as well use what I have.
Oh,
in front
oh,
of it.
I thought the scene was in the church. It was, you were literally performing in a church.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's why. I think people thought, like, you're already staging a rave and you already have boys making out in the pews. Like, maybe that's a little too far.
Yeah, that's consecrated space. Behave yourself.
Well,
there was great tension when Brian came across his mother in the church. We weren't too sure if Brian was going to out Father Tom to Joni.
To your point earlier about Brian reverting to 1.0, it would have been so in his back pocket to do that.
Yeah, I totally expected him to do it. And I like that he didn't do it because he just kind of dipped his toe back into the Brian 1.0 waters and then came out as Brian 2.0 and didn't do anything about it.
2.0 was resurrected, if you will.
It was a pretty strong scene. Joni was trying to get one over on Brian, but he just wasn't having it. He knows himself better than his mother knows him, which I thought was interesting because Joni is trying to say, I know you all too well. And Brian's like, nope.
Well, let's talk about Joni's stance in that moment because she brings up a lot of history.
Yeah, history that Brian had already moved on and he already kind of owned that.
And it reminded me a lot of, if you know the graphic novel, Fun Home, Alison Bechdel's graphic memoir, she talks, because the book as well as the musical that it's based on is about her being a closeted lesbian as well as her father being a closeted gay man. That hearing what Joni has experienced in the past 30 years of basically being with a man that has never loved her, who, what she says, would always want to go drinking with friends, didn't want to have Brian. It's as if she's bringing all of that up to say, this is what I've had to deal with. Can't you understand that I can't handle much more? And it's a little disheartening to know that because her son is gay, that's another thing that she can't handle. I don't know if it's her thinking that life has just dealt her the shittiest of shitty hands or what, but she tries to earn empathy in that moment. And I don't know if Brian is really there for that kind of handoff.
Father Tom shows up at Babylon buying drinks for everybody.
Yeah.
I don't think
he's out of his claw. He's out of the claw and he's just like, he's having a regular Friday night out. I'm like, what priesthood is this?
I don't know. Priests are still human too. Priests go out. They may not go to the bathhouse, but definitely go out. They don't stay in the rectory.
At this point, it's been well established that he does not follow a damn thing. So
I don't think that there was really any doubt ever that Brian was going to side with Father Tom, because when in doubt, Brian always sides with the queer. In the back of my head, when he was talking to his mother, I knew that he wasn't going to quite sell out Father Tom, because I don't think we ever see Brian sell out a queer in a situation like this. Sure, he'll like take advantage of them and fuck them, but he doesn't go out of his way to wreck them.
Yeah, like another great example is where he could have easily have outed Howard Bellwether.
Yeah, exactly.
But he doesn't. He doesn't sell. It seems like at least if you're queer, you're somewhat protected by Brian Kennedy.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we get back, we will talk about Ted, Emmett, and Jerk at Work.
We're hoping for sponsorship from Schickel's Pickles, so make sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes.
Still, queer as folk. So there's this great shot of Emmett getting off work in his construction man costume, complete with the jockstrap.
Jerkatwork.net has taken off. There are models everywhere. There are multiple staff.
I was kind of thinking that Ted basically invented Chatterbait because he has all this live porn going on. None of this is recorded. It's all live.
Did you catch that there was some male frontal nudity in the video cameras?
I did. I liked how one person was like pulling focus, like with a tape measure. It's like, whoa, it's still like high quality porn there.
The tape measure thing cracked me up. And I love that was such a great little detail to throw in there.
I thought it was a little weird that Emmett just happened to have Viagra for Ted's date.
He's in the biz.
Yeah.
I feel like Emmett could only rely on his natural talent for so long.
But that's what we were led to believe so far, is that Emmett was this great porn talent as Fetch Dixon.
And now it's like a regular 9-to-5. So, you know, he needs his Help.
There was a really nice trademark Bruce McDonald shot, which was the split screen of Emmett in this purple clawfoot tub with pink walls, and Ted's in his kind of drab, muted colored condo.
Waiting on Thor.
Well, he took the Viagra.
And so again, waiting on Thor, who at Babylon did not show any interest until he handed him his card and saw that he is the president of jerkatwork.net.
And Thor couldn't come over because Lulu, the dog, was throwing up. Do you think that was real, or do you think he was just blowing off Ted?
No, it was real, because there's a sound effect when he's on the phone that is of like you hear the retching.
But maybe Thor is just such a terrible actor that it just came across as like super fake.
Yeah, he didn't seem that concerned.
One of the funniest scenes was when Ted called Emmett from the porch of Mel and Lindsay's house where they're all having brunch. I liked how they all went and answered the door. It's really, really funny comedy writing there.
Because Emmett can't follow simple direction. Don't let anyone else come out here. Everyone walks out.
And Ted's wearing a trench coat.
Which I'm sure really helps when trying to hide an erection.
Well, it's like,
come on. Wearing a tent.
If you're hard, you can just like either point it up or point it down, whichever is the natural direction.
Right. Why do you think there's elastic on the underwear?
Be directed into a certain place.
You can tuck it away somehow.
And then this episode got incredibly 1950s, where they go to the doctor's office and there's like those old time screens set up.
So it's like, what doctor is this? What era are we?
Yeah. And did it's backlit.
Right. So we can get a very clear shadow of the doctor examining Ted's huge dick.
Yeah. And he's like,
he's balancing it. I'm like, what is going on?
His boner had lasted 2 days, which anybody that watches TV knows that an erection that lasts longer than four hours could be a... It's like, who's going to wait 2 days?
And I love what they're trying to find solutions. And the doctor says like, well, we could, you know, do a snip. And he's like,
it was insert two needles each side. Yeah. Yeah. That was a really funny scene.
You made my dick soft.
You have to broadcast it.
Hey, I'm soft. Look, I'm soft. Hey, I'm soft.
So let's recap this episode. Timeliness. I gave this 4 out of 5. The Brian and Father Tom story was ultimately about tolerance, I think. And a story like that is still pretty relevant in 2018.
Oh, I gave it a 3. I don't really find it about tolerance, because I feel like it was weird to me to watch this closeted priest, especially now what we know of.
I don't think he was that closeted.
Well, I mean, that is a good point, but I mean, at least his congregation does not know that he is this gay priest having anonymous sex in bathhouses. It was still weird that he's, you know, still this closeted priest and, you know, still hiding these secrets, but especially now that we have churches that are more open. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, especially even Catholic churches that are very much more welcoming.
So information accuracy, I give this one a 4. For once, I think that Queer as Folk showed a healthy, active, in control, HIV positive person that is totally relevant today. That's what you think of HIV positive people today. In 2002, I think it was stunning to see that, because mainstream media always portrayed it as something other than what we see now in 2018. So 4 out of 5.
Oh, I had to give it 5 for that. Like that was huge. You know, as I said earlier, I really applauded the show for being able to take that on and to show someone who could easily be a role model for that kind of not ashamed of the status and had no problem answering these questions and did it without any hesitation and with complete understanding, even though it felt like there was some ulterior motives behind it.
For relatability, I gave it 3 out of 5. I liked the episode. I really enjoyed it. But ultimately, I didn't immediately relate to it. It was just a nice, safe episode that didn't really go to the extremes that I like. The Ben HIV positive Michael story was pretty easy, so it didn't have huge amounts of drama. But it's kind of what I like in Bruce McDonald episodes. They're very pretty. They're fast paced. There's a tight plot to almost all of them. So here we had a really good A story, B story, and only one runner. We've had other episodes where there's at least 5 storylines going on. So yeah, it's an okay episode.
I give it 3.2, mainly because I sort of wish we had seen a different kind of relationship between Brian and his mother. I feel like we just got the stuff between him and his father. It was a retread of him and his mother. I would have loved to have seen that maybe there was something slightly more accepting, or there was a hint that maybe Joni knew anyway and she stuck it out. Like, that's why I stood up to your father so much. I understood that. I don't know. I would have liked to have have seen something done a little differently, because then it just shows that Brian had two really shitty parents. And I would have liked to have seen some sort of conflict that was the conflict between Joni and Jack to kind of help bring out why Brian is who he is.
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't really factor Jack so much into this episode other than what Joni Kinney was talking about Jack. So I almost wish that there was a couple scenes where those two characters were together so we could see that interplay between Joni and Jack.
That would be a great flashback moment, actually.
We never saw them together.
Nope. Well, that was episode 9 of season 2, Accentuate the Positive.
Next week, Debbie finds a body in the diner's dumpster.
But Law and Order theme. Chung, chung.
But Michael is more upset when his favorite comic book hero dies while George and Emmett get closer.
Oh, George Schickel. That's episode 10 of season 2, Priorities, Please Beat the Time.
Thanks for listening to Still Queer as Folk. Please rate and review us on iTunes. It really means a lot to us and helps us keep making these episodes.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Matt Dominguez.
And I'm Patrick Randall. We will see you next week. Still Queer as Folk was written and performed by Patrick Randall and Matt Dominguez. Made with love in Chicago.